It's Tuesday, April 6th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. It's wall-to-wall walls, as the Minnesota governor, Tim Walz, is Kamala Harris's pick as vice presidential candidate.
So, Pennsylvania, I'm here today because I found such a leader. Governor Tim Walz of the great state of Minnesota.
The Washington Post describing Walz as, quote, a blend of folksiness with a recent left-leaning record. Folksy, it's a sort of description no one ever says about themselves. Cutesy, there's another one. Homespun, usually you will just get a denial if you call someone's wisdom or insight homespun. It's just common sense, the folksy homespun sort will tell you. Here's what Walz did say.
I couldn't be prouder to be on this ticket and to help Vice President Harris become what we all know is very, very good for us to think about. Next president of the United States of America.
Now, as for Josh Shapiro, the governor of the very state where Walz delivered those remarks, he was supposed to be the favorite. Reports are that he tried. He tried to get out there. He tried to put himself forward. But this time, after Joshua fought the battle, the Walz did not come tumbling down. Was it because of Judaism or Israel or just because, as Kamala Harris professes, she loves herself some Tim Walz? What will it all mean? Well, we know this. We're going to get a whole lot of two Midwestern vice presidential candidates out humble beginnings each other. I'm from the holler, says J.D. Vance. My high school had 24 kids, says Tim Walz. You went to Yale, says Tim Walz. I went to Chadron State. Yes, Chadron State in Nebraska. So those two guys, Walz and Vance, both served our country in the military. Yeah, well, also Congress. But that seems less servy than having servants. Anyway, Walz was enlisted in the Army National Guard. He enlisted in Nebraska in 1981, one of my favorite Springsteen albums of that period. He reached the rank of Command Sergeant Major, but retired as a Master Sergeant, which is lower, something about not completing a course. But it's still among NCOs, non-commissioned officers. People familiar with the military hold those ranks in very high regard. Those NCOs are the glue of units. A lieutenant, well, all officers obviously outrank those NCOs, any NCO, but a command sergeant major is the kind of individual who has the knowledge of the unit, the institutional knowledge, the practical experience. They make the military run. Vance, too, achieved a rank of corporal in the Marines. They were in the service, as far as I could tell, at overlapping times as Walz ended his National Guard service, as Vance was in basic training and perhaps first deployed. You can imagine the young J.D. Vance, then J.D. Hamill, being impressed with the older, more experienced, higher-ranking Walz. You can imagine the older Walz, by the end of his National Guard service, seeing something in the quite bright young Marine. But now they've been elevated far beyond those roles, elevated to positions that I bet you back then they could hardly ever dream of. But back then, when they were each in the service, those were the kinds of positions that America depends on. The humble civil servants and servicemen who are committed to a unified cause. But now, each of them have ascended to the highest echelons of American society. And as such, unification has no place. They are each obligated to tear the other down and call the other a socialist or a weirdo. And one of those might be quite accurate, by the way. There's something about the nature or success, or maybe it's just the responsibility of power. I shouldn't be so romantic. When you're in charge of steering the ship rather than just funneling the coal into the oven, you have a lot of decisions to make, and even your precise differences in calculations affect many, many, many people. Or maybe it's that the highest reaches of power warp a person. Or maybe it's about how humble circumstances flatten us all. They give us a common goal and you don't think about much else, rising beyond your station. So all of this is characteristic of our society, our polarized, siloed, but also individualistic and dynamic society, for good and ill. The ill will quite conspicuously be on display. There will be no mistaking that. 72 days before the first ballots are cast, 90 days until Election Day. Plenty of time to hear all the contrasts, probably forget about any of the commonalities. On the show today, Who better to talk about an impact of a vice presidential pick than Martin Van Buren? No, we couldn't get him. We couldn't get the Wizard of Kinderhook. So we got Nate Silver, who is excellent at election forecasting. Will this pick have a big impact? Nate will tell us. That is the spiel. But first, Shad White is the youngest state auditor in the country working for Mississippi, and he joins to discuss his new book, Mississippi Swindle, Brett Favre and the Welfare Scandal That Shocked America. We shall break the case down from how it came to his attention, what the subpoena powers allowed him to find out, and how, well, the person we mentioned, quarterback Brett Favre, got his wranglers all caught up in this thing. Shadrick White up next. When misappropriation of funds in the state of Mississippi happens, it usually doesn't go national. But when Brett Favre is involved, it has a chance to. Now, the Brett Favre connection is laid out and it's prominent in the book written by my next guest, Shad White. The name of the book is Mississippi Swindle. Here is the subtitle, Brett Favre and the Welfare Scandal That Shocked America. But you should know that while Favre was an important part of the overall story, he wasn't charged with a crime. And he, if anything, exemplifies the real rot and the real waste that maybe we wouldn't have even known about had someone as famous as Favre not been involved. Shad White is the state auditor for Mississippi, and he joins me now. Thank you, Mr. White. Should I call you Auditor White?
No, come on. Call me Shad. It's good to be here, Mike. Thanks, man.
So I'm going to ask you, and maybe we could do this in a couple of questions, because it takes a while, and your office has produced some really excellent videos that takes the viewer through it. But what was the nature of the misappropriation of funds that were originally intended for welfare recipients through the program TANDF?
Yeah, TANF, typically known as welfare. The short version of the story of what happened down here in Mississippi is that we draw down millions and millions of dollars of TANF funds, welfare funds from the federal government because we have a high poverty rate in Mississippi. And my team did an investigation along with a large comprehensive audit. And we found two big important things. Number one, north of $100 million of welfare funds were misspent down here. And when I say misspent, I mean wasted on things that that are not allowable expenditures of welfare funds. So advertisements in a newspaper, advertisements at a college bowl game out of state, donations to beauty pageants, donations to the American Heart Association, things that didn't have any direct connection to helping poor people. So that was big thing number one. And big thing number two is we discovered a criminal scheme at the heart of this, involving the head of the agency down here who handles all of the welfare funds, and then several kind of key players around Mississippi, one woman who ran an influential local nonprofit. And based on that criminal investigation, prosecutors have now charged and obtained guilty pleas on seven individuals, with another one charged as well, awaiting trial. All told, it's the largest public fraud scheme in the history of the state of Mississippi, which is tragic. And really, the reason I wrote the book about this was to tell people what happened here and also to inform the rest of the country, because I think that the ingredients are there for this to happen really in any other state. And my hope is that we can inform people so that it doesn't happen, that people will take precautions.
Now, the official at the center of this, John Davis?
Correct.
He knew what he was doing. He authorized underlings to write checks within the office and walk to a local bank and to cover up his tracks. This was, and you give me the state of the adjudication against him, this seems to be, and the details are either funny or tragic or stupid, like the wrestler Ted DiBiase, who's apparently a reverend and does some work with the state, essentially giving kickbacks to this individual. But before we get to other aspects, I just want you to lay out what have been the charges, where does that stand, in what read to me as a pretty classic example of a government official getting kickbacks for directing public funds at his discretion to inappropriate causes.
Yeah, so the main figure here that enabled all this to happen is John Davis, the head of the agency in Mississippi that handles all of our welfare funds. And John Davis fell into league with Brett DiBiase, who's one of the sons of Ted DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man, if anybody watches wrestling out there. Brett DiBiase and John Davis became friends. And so at some point, John funneled some money through a nonprofit. This nonprofit was run by an influential woman down here named Nancy New. And they used some of those welfare funds to pay for a treatment for Brett to go to drug rehab in Malibu, California. They were also paying Brett a salary. And this, of course, is not an allowable use of welfare funds. You can't pay for some guy's drug treatment at a resort facility when that money's supposed to go to poor people. That's one of the key things that we uncovered very, very early. And once we realized that, we start asking questions. And the answers that we got back were, well, you know, this was really to train Brett on how to teach classes for people who are addicted to drugs. And of course, that was a lie. And based on that and several other facts, prosecutors charged both of those individuals, Brett DiBiase and John Davis. Both have pleaded guilty to charges. John's pleaded guilty to both federal and state charges. They haven't been sentenced yet. They'll be sentenced probably sometime in the next 12 months. But that formed the basis of one of the ways in which money was misspent down here. And unfortunately, what happened after that is John just kept doing things with this money, funneling it through this nonprofit, and then instructing them to spend it in a lot of different ways, some of which benefited him. So like they bought him an off-the-books black Yukon that he could use, some of which didn't necessarily benefited him, but it helped some of his family members, like a nephew or brother-in-law or whatever it may be. And once you piled all those things up, that's what made this fraud scheme incredibly expensive for the state.
By the way, how did your office working with prosecutors determine that this wasn't a training session for Brett DiBiase in Malibu, it was drug rehab?
We got the recorded audio of John Davis calling the Malibu facility with Brett DiBiase on the line. So we had audio of them talking directly about how Brett needed help. And then, of course, we dig in and, you know, we see a lot of documents and it's painfully obvious that they're treating him. They're not teaching him how to teach a class.
Right. I was just wondering if there was any sort of doctor-patient confidentiality complications in getting that audio tape.
We have pretty broad subpoena power here, especially if the object of the expenditure has been paid for with government money. So we leveraged that subpoena power to get to the bottom of this and had to do that a lot. You know, we made a lot of document requests out there around town. A lot of them got rejected. So that's basically us just saying, hey, can you give us these documents? Something's weird here. And a lot of people turned us down. So we threw a lot of subpoenas around and got what we needed.
So as I said, the John Davis component of it is pretty classic and pretty nefarious, but many, many a government official in return of directing state money will get a kickback. This is a kickback scheme. The details of it are tawdry. He's facing sentencing. Then there is this character of Nancy New. And I say character because you could tell me a little bit about her. But her business seems to be a particularly Mississippi-inflected and specific kind of way to work one over on the welfare system, because she had schools. You tell me if any of them had any degree of legitimacy, and welfare is used to train people who need skills. So there is an ostensible overlap, but what she did, she rode right through the loopholes in those laws. Tell me a little bit about Nancy New and her schools and what she did to, quote unquote, earn her TANF money.
So Nancy is a figure down here in Mississippi. She was a school administrator and at some point in the past set up a school for kids with disabilities. And there were real children who were served by this school and it operated down here. I know some families who sent their kids there. She also had this nonprofit on the side, the Mississippi Community Education Center. That was largely run by her and her son, Zach New. And so really this went off the rails when that nonprofit started drawing down huge, huge grants of welfare money. So they pulled down these big grants, tens of millions of dollars at a time. And then John Davis would go to the nonprofit and he would say, hey, now that I've given you that welfare money, I need you to do something for me. And so, for example, one of them would be go pay for Brett's treatment in Malibu. So they keep getting these kinds of orders basically from John, or requests from John. And they all know, they've all signed documents that say that that kind of stuff is not the kind of stuff that you can spend TANF money on. But if you're Nancy New, you probably know that if you tell John no, the money's going to dry up. That's the whole problem. This is a kind of classic pay-to-play scenario. So they keep doing what John wants. And then over time, it seems to us like Nancy and Zach New realize that nobody's really watching this money. So the money comes into their nonprofit. It's there in the bank account. And now they have this, they have access to this big slush fund, so they can do kind of whatever they want with it without anybody asking questions. So they buy cars with it. They bought three cars with it. They start buying technology with it. Nancy used a portion of government funds to buy herself another house here in Jackson, kind of in a nicer part of Jackson, Mississippi. Zach New went and took a loan out against his 401k, and then he repaid it with welfare money. So they were doing a lot of different little bitty things to personally benefit from this pool of welfare funds. And the money kept flowing because John Davis was getting what he wanted out of them as well.
Do they approach Brett Favre, or is it the other way around? Somehow Brett Favre gets into the orbit of Nancy New, and the idea of you can build a volleyball stadium, a bricks and mortar, and that's important, volleyball stadium with welfare money gets not only floated but pursued. Take me through that.
It's not super clear how these two got connected, Nancy New and Brett Favre, but what we know is at some point they do get connected. And Brett Favre at the time was trying to raise money for a volleyball court at the University of Southern Mississippi, his alma mater. And ultimately what we found is that about $5 million of welfare funds got sent over to pay for that volleyball court. That's not an allowable use of TANF funds. TANF funds can't be used to build any sort of brick and mortar facilities. But in addition to that, New sent Favre Enterprises $1.1 million, and we know from text messages that this was somehow related to that volleyball court, but $1.1 million goes to Favre Enterprises, and then as a result, Brett Favre was supposed to give a series of speeches according to the contract that they had with Favre Enterprises and do some appearances and that sort of thing. And we found when we started checking into this that those were not done. And so that was in our audit and it came out. And of course, Mr. Favre has been pretty angry about that and has sued me for pointing that out. The other piece to know about here is when Nancy and Favre are texting about all this, Favre acknowledges that he's getting money that's supposed to go to people in shelters. That was his word that he used. He, of course, knows that, you know, a lot of the funds that he's trying to get are government funds because he's pushing John Davis, a government official, to try to get the funds. He's pushing Governor Phil Bryant, who's a government official, obviously, to try to get the funds. And then Favre texted Nancy New that he hoped that they could keep all this confidential. So really, those are some of the more damning facts, I think, that have come out of all this.
It is damning. One question is, if Brett Favre had given those speeches, even for $1.5 million, would that have been okay? I don't mean ethically. I mean under the law.
Likely no, because, again, we'd have to find a way to tie that back to one of the allowable uses of TANF funds. And so we'd have to figure out, okay, well, if you were saying that you were going to give this speech to a bunch of poor people to inspire them, how many poor people showed up? So those would be the kinds of questions that we would ask if we went down that road. But the truth of the matter is $1.1 million in TANF funds got moved over to Favre Enterprises. And the only justification that we were given for that transfer of funds was this kind of shoddy little contract that had been allegedly signed by Favre Enterprises CPA, a guy named Robert Columber. And Brett Favre just simply didn't do those things. Now, whether he knew to do those things or whether they made up this contract or whatever it may be, for the purposes of the law, it doesn't really matter. What matters is this was the contract and he was supposed to do this stuff and he didn't do it. Alternatively, you could say, well, maybe that was a fake contract. Maybe they forged Robert Columber's signature. If there was no contract to justify giving Favre Enterprises $1.1 million, they still can't get $1.1 million. You got to have a contract requiring you to do something for the taxpayers in order to get that money. So there's just a bunch of problems. There are a bunch of problems with that flow of funds.
Now, if I were Brett Favre's lawyer, and he has many of them, I would look at these text messages that do seem damning and argue he was worried about his public image. He wasn't knowingly engaged in a criminal enterprise. He was asking for advice from the person who was steering the money. Things like, is this legal? Can we keep my name out of it? Seems like it could be. A good prosecutor could make this case. Some sort of admission of a guilty mind. On the other hand, you could all say he's a public figure who doesn't want it known that these speeches he's giving that seem to be just charity is he's getting payment for. Even if that was totally legal, keeping my name out of it or keeping the payments out of it might be something that Brett Favre would say. So I'm sure you're familiar with all these, but my question is, does the ambiguity, to the degree that there is some ambiguity of those messages, did that factor into the decision not to charge Favre?
It's a good question. And to be honest with you, I can't answer it because that's really the call of the prosecutor. You know, my role and my team's role here is to dig up the facts. So we're kind of similar to the FBI in the sense that we dig up the facts and then we're going to hand that over to a prosecutor, whether it's a local DA, attorney general, federal prosecutor. And so a lot of times those conversations that you're talking about, oh, what does this text mean? How would you interpret this? Those conversations happen among prosecutors behind closed doors without us even in there. Sometimes they'll share the content of those conversations. Sometimes they'll ask us what we think. But for the most part, they're making that decision on their own. And yeah, I mean, I think that if you're Favre's lawyers, you're going to make one argument about what those texts mean and the public can interpret them however they want. But as to what specifically has led prosecutors one way or the other, I couldn't speak to it because I'm not in the room.
Has Favre cooperated with the investigation or the criminal case?
Favre did sit down with FBI agents, and that meeting included an agent from my office and was asked about this. The contents of that are left to the FBI, basically, what happened in that meeting. So anyway, short answer is there was a sit down at some point, and so prosecutors have access to that information along with all of this other stuff. Another important point I think to make here is that, you know, my office, I think we have great investigators. We've got a great team. We've got about 135 people here in the Mississippi State Auditor's Office. But to make sure that everybody understood that this case was going to be thoroughly investigated and this wasn't just some big, massive ordeal that's beyond our capacity to handle, I gave everything that we have over to the FBI and worked with them, allowed them to work from my office for a while back during COVID. And this was over 4 years ago. So really, you did have two very good agencies, especially these local FBI guys down here, two good law enforcement agencies trying to tackle the same question. So at the end of the day, all the facts are going to be dug up. The real big meta question here is what a prosecutor is going to do with it.
Shad White is the 42nd state auditor of the state of Mississippi, and his book, Mississippi Swindle, Brett Favre and the Welfare Scandal That Shocked America, is out now. Thank you so much.
Thanks, brother. I appreciate you.
Tim Walz is Kamala Harris's vice presidential running mate, who is pretty moderate while in Congress, more left-leaning as governor of Minnesota, has a fine background, and is from a small town in Nebraska. Josh Shapiro is none of those things. He was, however, the front runner to be Kamala Harris's running mate, the Pennsylvania governor, stood by as the pick went to Walz in his home state and on the stage in Philadelphia. Here to analyze it is Nate Silver. He's the founder of 538 at that forecasting site. He predicted many a presidential election. I'm going to say correctly. He also has taken that model to the Silver Bulletin Substack, where for a small price, you could get insight into all that he has been finding about presidential odds and chances, or you could just listen right here on The Gist, because Nate has come by. Nate, I know that your choice would have been Josh Shapiro, and as far as I could tell from your analysis between him and Tim Walz, the major selling point on Shapiro is just that he's from Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania is quite an important state in picking a vice presidential or running mate from a very big, important swing state is just smart strategy. Is that about right?
He's probably worth half a point to a point. You might win the Electoral College.
Shapiro is,
right?
Yeah.
In Pennsylvania, it's the state that determines the election outcome about a third of the time in our models. So, you know, getting essentially an extra half point to a point a third of the time is pretty valuable. I mean, not massively. I mean, the election may turn out to be a route in one direction or another still, or maybe Harris uses a southern route and wins Georgia and states like that, which he's doing a lot better than Biden. But yeah, it's, you know, making those 19 electoral votes more secure for her, and the empirical proof that, like, say what you want about Josh Shapiro, but Pennsylvania is a very representative state. That's why it's a swing state. It has rural areas and a huge city and suburbs, and it has a pretty substantial African-American population. It has big universities. It has lots of different things, and he's been successful there, which is a state that's more representative in the country than Minnesota, and Pennsylvania is a bigger state than Minnesota in terms of electoral votes, too. So, and he's a very talented politician. To me, it seemed like kind of the no-brainer pick. The fact that they seem to tease at that, the announcements taking place in Pennsylvania, and kind of trial ballooned, and then the trial balloon popped, gives me some questions about their process. Now, look, I happen to think that Tim Walz is a decent to good pick in a vacuum. I mean, he, you know, as a Midwesterner, his affect kind of works for me, and he actually has a pretty moderate track record in Congress, has been more progressive as a governor, but, like, I don't mind people adapting their positions to their constituencies. I think that's actually what you should have in representative democracy. So I think it's a perfectly fine pick, but I do feel like it's a little bit of a, you had Luka Doncic at, you know, number three, and you picked, I don't think he's DeAndre Ayton. He's better than that. Are you an NBA guy or not? But, like, it's, I think you need a...
Yeah, I know. It's Luka or Trey, and I think we know how that has played.
Yeah, maybe it's maybe it's Trey Young, you know?
Although Luka and Tim are both the fleshier guys, let's just say that. Anyway, isn't it the case, however, and I read your analysis of why Shapiro would be good, and you do, is it 10,000 simulations, and in of those 10,000, maybe 1,900 to do that 5.5% swing in Pennsylvania come into effect. But my point there is that's all the quantifiable stuff, and the objective quantifiable stuff does argue slightly for Shapiro. The other stuff, which might argue for Walz, like his skill as a speaker, her reaction to him, is less quantifiable. So isn't there a danger of discounting that, you know, from your perspective?
I mean, the way I put it is that it's within the margin of error, right? I think the Shapiro bar is better than the Walz bar, but there's some overlap. Harris has also moved up in our forecast from like a 38% chance of beating Trump to like a 53% chance or something. If she were a big favorite, if she were a 3-to-1 favorite, then I might say, okay, now you do want to be risk averse, because I think Shapiro, he would have caused a bad news cycle or two where the left freaks out about it and Israel-Gaza stuff becomes more salient again. So there is an actual cost. It's not a risk-free decision. I think maybe he's getting at earlier. I mean, he is kind of he's kind of called the Jewish Obama a little bit, right? But, imagine if you had a Joe Biden-Obama ticket instead of the other way around. I mean, Harris is a little bit more dynamic than Joe Biden, but, like that might have been a little bit weird, and I wonder if that played into thinking. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they were kind of going this direction and got cold feet, I mean, that process seems not great. I think I would have like concocted some excuse where Shapiro has to get ready for 2026 or something like that and have him bow out on his own terms. It's a little weird. I've been busy all day, so I haven't had a chance to like read the what we call TikToks in the industry about how this choice was made. But the process seems not great. The outcome seems decent to good, but not optimal, I guess.
Right. So let me ask you this, though, since you mentioned Harris's rise in your model. So much of the early pricing in, not just in your model, but in polls, were based on the hypothetical matchup between Harris and Trump. And it seems like that hypothetical matchup got it wrong. Now, I know polls are a snapshot, so things actually change when someone is named the nominee, and then you can see all the things around them that fall into place, like Democratic unity or media coverage. So it does seem that what has changed is now that Harris is the actual nominee, we see all this excitement around it that we didn't have when Biden was the nominee. But shouldn't that have been somewhat captured by the very idea of a hypothetical matchup? When you ask people, what about if Harris were the nominee? Shouldn't they say to themselves, or maybe the pollster should prompt them, and now, remember, this will mean that Joe Biden is not the nominee. And then shouldn't they get somewhat excited like they did in real life? So that's my question. Is there a fundamental flaw with the hypothetical matchup polling that we see playing out in real time?
I think in general, I mean, I don't know why that is exactly, but it's just always been the case that, like, until you actually have the matchup set, the polling tends to be pretty unreliable, right? And remember, like, most swing voters, most undecided voters are, like, not necessarily the most well-informed people. You know, maybe some people didn't know that Joe Biden was going to drop out or something like that. And Kamala Harris had not received that much exposure as a candidate necessarily. She had a bad campaign, frankly, in 2019, dropped out well before Iowa. The Biden White House, I think, did her very few favors, giving her the border and other assignments. I mean, there's a technical question here, too, about, like, so we waited 7 or 8 days after Harris became the nominee to turn the model back on. She clearly was still at that point moving up further ahead in the polls. I mean, you know, momentum is, I think, 9 times out of 10, like an overrated consequence in politics, overrated factor. I think this might actually be a case where it's true, where it's like, oh, actually, like, this is kind of exciting. We've had 3 elections in a row, counting the Biden version of this election, where we have these old, settle, eat-your-spinach candidates. And now we have someone who's at least a little bit hipper and younger, relatively speaking. She's almost in Gen X even, right? She missed it by like 3 months or something. And also kind of, there's a selection effect where, like, you get rid of all the Biden dead-enders who are running his campaign. They were discredited and, like, are now selected out of the party, right? So you get rid of all the people that I think had this failing strategy for Biden and thought this was going to sell to people and replace them with some fresher ideas that's been bottled up a little bit. And so, look, it could prove to be like a high watermark. She does have vulnerabilities. She has vulnerabilities around being tied to Biden, around being too far left in 2019, 2020. I think people overrate the importance, the penalty that would be given to like a woman candidate, a black woman even more so, but somebody's going to lose her vote because of that, right? You have to say at least the Trump campaign seems a little bit rattled. And in poker, when you have, I mean, he thought that he was just going to kind of coast to victory. And when I saw
this informed his choice of JD Vance. You said if you're 3-1, you might just want to appoint the vice president you want. Okay, he was something close to 2-1, and he at that time that he appointed JD Vance. So that was him misreading how static the race was.
Yeah. So, you know, at that moment where he raises his fist, which is a moment I have to give Trump a lot of credit for, right? I think a lot of people are just like, oh, he's just going to win, right? He's going to win, and maybe we'll be watching Virginia and Minnesota to see how much he wins by, but he's just going to win at this point because Biden's going to, you know, a walking corpse, and here he is surviving an assassination attempt and raising his fist in the wind. And then he starts to make mistakes, right? He kind of makes what I think is a fairly bad pick in J.D. Vance, and he gives this convention speech where the first half hour is kind of pretty good. And then he drones on for another hour about random Trump shit. And then he's trialing out these weird racial attacks on the Vice President Harris. And like, it just, yeah, I don't know. I mean, some people, when they lose a big stack in poker, start to tilt off. And there's a little bit of a sense of that.
Yeah. Do you think just from analysis standpoint, when interviewed by the NABJ, he engaged in a historical explanation of how vice presidents don't usually matter. Was he more or less right about that?
No, I think it's, I mean, look at what happened to Kamala Harris, right? This choice that was made at 3 a.m, just like her choice. I mean, the chance that you become a candidate for president or become president when you're the VP pick is quite high. Joe Biden was somebody who Obama supposedly thought, oh, he's so old that he won't run for president himself. And then Biden skips 4 years and then does run twice. By the way, Biden ran and lost in this election, right? He was a candidate for president and he did not receive the party's nomination, is how that will kind of go down in the, you know,
yeah,
in the politicsreference.com version of Biden's baseball card. He ran and lost. But no, the VP picks are a very big deal for kind of future governance. And that's kind of what, that's what's interesting for Shapiro is like, you know, if Harris loses, I guess maybe now he's at least better positioned potentially. I wonder how he feels about this. You know, I'm sure he's very ambitious. I'm sure he's a little pissed off. And so we'll see.
Yeah. Last question is just give me your expectation of a Democratic National Convention bump. There's usually a bump, but this was such a weird campaign that perhaps she got a pre-bump in the last couple of weeks. Do you expect a bump still to happen?
I mean, the bumps have gotten smaller over the years. Look, I suppose I do. It's like kind of 4 days of free advertising, right? It's she's at least a little bit more new than Biden would have been, right? I mean, you know, it's still you still have like a compressed year-long cycle that's being squashed now into 4 days. And our model will assume she's getting a bump, and if she doesn't start to show leads where she's ahead by Trump of 3 or 4 points, then it'll start to penalize her in the model for what it's worth. But we'll see. Tim Walz will give a good speech, I think. They're putting Biden on day one, you know, trying to avoid as much of that as possible, I think. But we'll see.
Nate, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mike. Talk to you soon.
That's it for today's show. The show is produced by the Quaint Mallards. Corey Warr is the producer and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca spearheads special projects for us at Peachfish. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oompuru-jee-puru-doo-puru, and thanks for listening.